Griffith was born Calvin Robertson in Montreal, Quebec in 1911. One of seven children in a poverty-stricken family, Calvin was sent at age 11 to live with an aunt and uncle in Washington, D.C., where he could indulge in three square meals a day. When his father died a year later, young Calvin was adopted by his uncle, Clark Griffith, a turn-of-the-century pitcher and manager who had purchased baseball's Washington Senators in 1919. Calvin became the Senators' bat boy. In 1995, he told NPR how, following afternoons at the ballpark, he would sit at the knee of his adoptive father, soaking up the older man's abundant knowledge of the game.
After dinner, we'd sit in the living room or in a den, and he would get his pencil and paper out and start talking about ball players, what ones he would like to get, and make batting orders and all that. So I got all the dope from him about how to play the game and why this should be done and why that should be done.
Griffith called himself the Senators' mascot, and he was such a part of the team that he joined them at the White House for photo sessions after their World Series seasons of 1924 and 25. He later managed minor league teams in Charlotte and Chattanooga. He loved the challenge of trying to win a baseball game with his wits, and once described his managing days as the best years of his life. In 1941, Calvin was called back to the family business to oversee concession sales at Senators games. The rationing in place during World War II made it more difficult, but Griffith was resourceful.
I was the one that started putting ice in the cups and pouring the Coca-Colas in there. I found out you could get two Coca-Colas out of one bottle. So, and I had cups, tops on it and everything else. We went first class.
Griffith rose through the management ranks from concession manager to team president, and he inherited majority ownership of the Senators when Clark Griffith died in 1955. A keen understanding of the game led Calvin to be more involved in the day-to-day operations of his baseball team than many other owners were. He occasionally offered instruction to Senators managers. In 1959, Griffith advised Cookie Lavigetto to make room in the lineup for a youngster named Harmon Killebrew.
He was a great judge of baseball talent, and he felt that Ike was ready to play, and he told Cookie Lavigetto that. I don't think Mr. Lavigetto believed that at the time, but Calvin got Cookie to put me in the lineup, and I hit a home run opening day that year and won the last day of the season to tie with Rocky Colavito of the Indians for my first home run championship.
After the 1960 season, Griffith responded to financial incentives from Hams Beer and other sponsors by moving the Senators to Minnesota.
Minnesota has Twins, and the whole state is celebrating. The Twins, in this case, is their first Major League Baseball team, and 25,000 are on hand for the opener. By the way, neither Minneapolis nor St. Paul, ancient rivals, is home court. They play in Bloomington, 7 miles from either city.
The Twins put Minnesota back on the pro sports map after basketball's Lakers had forsaken Minneapolis for Los Angeles. The Twins drew big crowds to Met Stadium throughout the 60s, and in 1965, Griffith was named baseball's Executive of the Year as Minnesota won the American League pennant before dropping the World Series to Sandy Koufax and the Los Angeles Dodgers. The Twins continued to operate as a family business, and Calvin Griffith was the patriarch. Stubborn and strong-willed, Griffith said he was always honest with the fans and with himself, and said he treated his players as if they were his own children. Outfielder Tony Oliva, the 1964 Rookie of the Year, grew up in Cuba and remembers leaning on Griffith during his transition to life in the United States.
Griffith was like a father to me because, you know, a lot of times you need somebody to talk to or coming the right time on the bedtime. He's always was there, and he all the time having good advice for you.
In the 1970s, player salaries began climbing rapidly, and Griffith pulled no punches in complaining that ballplayers were overpaid. Pitcher Bert Blyleven remembers that salary negotiations with Griffith were not very negotiable.
We didn't have agents at that time. We didn't have free agency. You had to negotiate with Mr. Griffith one-on-one, and you had to make an appointment to meet with him, and you would go into his office, and he would sit in a high chair behind a high desk, and you would sit in a couch that sank down. So it was like you're looking up about 10 feet at this big owner, because he was a big man. And he would basically tell you what you're going to make the next year, whether it be a $50 raise or a $1,000 raise. Basically, he says, this is what I think you're worth, son. and this is what I'd like for you to sign at.
Infielder Roy Smalley, who was traded to the Twins in 1976, agrees that among players, Griffith had a reputation as a miser.
I don't think people liked playing for Calvin. He was very tough, and he was kind of curmudgeonly and tight.
But Smalley, who was an investment advisor for Dane Rauscher, says looking back, he now appreciates Griffith's situation. As people who had made millions in other fields began purchasing baseball teams and driving up salaries, Griffith was one of the last pure baseball men whose only business was his ball club.
He was a real throwback to the old baseball owners that really knew something about the game, which is not to say that he knew more than his managers or anybody else, but that he had working for him. But he did know an awful lot, and he took an interest in it, and he watched the games. And you know, it's like Yogi Berra said, you can see a lot by looking. And Calvin watched with interest, and he had a more than a passing knowledge. He was great in that regard.
The late 70s and early 80s were difficult for Griffith and the Twins. African Americans boycotted Twins games for a time after newspaper accounts quoted Griffith making racial slurs in a 1978 speech before the Waseca Lions Club. Griffith took exception to the quotes. But the Twins began struggling on the field. The organization signed several good young players who would come up through the Twins' minor league system, then leave Minnesota for more lucrative contracts with other teams. Calvin's son, Clark Griffith, remembers there were tensions within the family business.
When we argued, it was because I would walk in and I'd want to talk about business and broadcasting and finance. And those were three things he had no interest in.
In 1984, Calvin Griffith wept at the signing ceremony during which he sold the Twins to Minneapolis banker Carl Pohlad for $38 million. Griffith continued to attend Twins games regularly for a few years and was a prominent figure in Minnesota. Jack Ruler, artistic director of Mixed Blood Theater in Minneapolis, wrote a biographical play of Griffith's life and remembers Calvin taking him to a warehouse where a collection of mementos dating back to 1907 was stored.
He'd never thrown out a swizzle stick, a box of matches, any baseball memorabilia or paraphernalia. His favorite thing was he had a letter from Fidel Castro, who wanted to try out with the team back in the early 50s.
Once the pressures of owning a team were removed, Calvin Griffith's relationship with his family improved. Son Clark says he grew closer to his father in the last 10 years.
I was thinking last night as I was driving to Melbourne, Florida, to be with him, that the last out of the National League Championship Series would have been a moment in which I would have picked up the phone and dialed his number, knowing he was watching the same game, and we would have spent time just discussing how the game ended or certain plays during the game. And, I certainly missed that.
Calvin Griffith died at the age of 87. He will be buried in Washington, D.C. I'm William Wilcoxon, Minnesota Public Radio.